You are listening to the Sermon Podcast from the Vandalia Church of Christ in Lubbock, Texas. We are a community that believes in the value of all people. You can find out more about us at www.vandalia.org or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Vandalia Church.
What we're going to be doing today is focusing on the first couple of chapters of the first chapter of Matthew, the birth story from the Gospel of Matthew. These birth stories are counter stories. Behind the birth stories in the Gospels are other very different stories that people were telling and sharing about Jesus of Nazareth. We get hints of this throughout the Gospels. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? Nathanael asks his brother Philip. Some call Jesus Beelzebul, a servant of the devil. Others called him crazy. They called him unclean, a drunkard, a glutton, a lawbreaker. Others knew that all they needed to do to malign his character, to discredit him, to reveal his disgrace, was simply to say that he was a friend of tax collectors and sinners. These are the stories that are circulating, competing with the early testimony of the disciples in the years following Christ's death. Those in power have always been highly motivated to discredit and ignore those who challenge them. Those who assume that glory and superiority are the same thing have always had a hard time seeing those below them, hearing or valuing their voices. In the face of those stories, Matthew tells his story. So we begin in Matthew 1:18. Now the birth of Jesus the Messiah took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been engaged to Joseph, but before they lived together, she was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. Her husband Joseph, being a righteous man and unwilling to expose her to public disgrace, planned to dismiss her quietly. But just when he had resolved to do this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, "Joseph, son of David, don't be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for the child conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. "Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. When Joseph woke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him. He took her as his wife, but had no marital relations with her until she had borne a son, and he named him Jesus. On the morning of the 11th of October, 2014, we were sleeping peacefully. Well, I was sleeping peacefully. Jocelyn was doing whatever a woman in the final days of pregnancy does at night. We woke up early. Jocelyn was having pains and contractions. We knew that the day was approaching and we had our bags packed. We'd assembled the crib. We had diapers and wipes at the ready, though no one could really have prepared me for what I would find in those diapers in the next few days. So anyway, we wake up that morning and we are ready to go. Margot was on her way. We get our bags, we pack the car, we drive to the hospital. And of course, since it was 2014, we pause in front of the hospital and take a selfie. And then we go inside. And then they tell us we were wrong. Margot's not actually ready to arrive yet. So we head home for another 6 or 7 hours. Then finally we go back. Margot was born. Everything was fine. Now, there are a lot of parallels with the story of the birth of Christ. The waiting, the expectation, the anxiety, angelic hosts. These are all a normal part of everyone's birth story. But there are also many significant differences to think about. First, a normal birthday story. We tell these stories for the sake of posterity, nostalgia, entertainment, historical value. These are the sorts of stories that come out at holidays, round the table, rehearsal dinners. But this is not why Matthew is telling this story. We celebrate people's birthdays because we want to give them a feeling of reassurance, encouragement, build them up, remind them of how much they mean to their families, their friends. We tell and celebrate these stories for their sake, right? That's not why Matthew is telling this story. Matthew does not tell the story for the sake of nostalgia or simply to record a neutral, sterile, benign historical event. And he's not telling this story because he thinks the Son of God needs reminding of something. In other words, I hate to spoil it for... Can you bring up the next picture? I hate to spoil it for those of you who like to go overboard with your Christmas decor, but Matthew is not saying, "Happy birthday, Jesus," when he tells this story. You can take it down. He tells the story, and we retell it year after year, not for Jesus' sake, but for our sake, because we need reminding of something. Like the Jews at annual Passover celebrations. Remember, they're instructed, when your children ask you, tell them, remind them of what happened. We need reminding throughout our lives because we are prone to forgetting it with our lips, with our minds, with our actions, with our hearts. So what is it exactly that we need reminding of? To figure that out, as always, we need a bit of context. So we have to back up to the start of chapter 1 of Matthew. Listen carefully. An account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar. Perez the father of Hezron, and Hezron the father of Aram. Aram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon, who was the father of Salmon, who was the father of Boaz by Rahab. Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth. Obed the father of Jesse. Jesse the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. And Solomon the father of Rehoboam, who was the father of Abijah, who was the father of Asaph, the father of Jehoshaphat, father of Joram, the father of Uzziah, who was the father of Jotham, who was the father of Ahaz, who was the father of Hezekiah, who was the father of Manasseh, who was the father of Amos, who was the father of Josiah, who was the father of... Stay with me. Who was the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Salathiel, who was the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abiud, who was the father of Eliakim, who was the father of Azor, who was the father of Zadok, who was the father of Achim, who was the father of Eliud. We're almost done. Eliud was the father of Eleazar, who was the father of Mathan, who was the father of Jacob, who was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. That is a terrible way to begin a story. I bet most of you, like most of my students, lost consciousness somewhere around Amminadab. Why does Matthew begin his book this way? Why give a long list of names? Well, it's because we are not just defined and understood by looking at our own present moment, but by seeing who came before us. Part of my own story is the story of my father's family's flight from Sweden to Russia and then to a Mennonite community in Mexico a century and a half ago. The next part of the story involved their flight from that Mennonite community to another in Canada. My grandfather apparently had bought a truck with some shiny chrome bumpers on it, and that was verboten, so they went to a different community up in Canada. My small story, my small moment, becomes clearer as a part of this bigger story, which has shaped who I am in ways I probably can't conceive. We tell these stories, we name our ancestors as a way of establishing and understanding our identity. What Matthew is doing at the start of chapter 1 is telling the big story. This is terribly important when you're trying to defend a person in the face of a tidal wave of fake news. Trying to convince a whole population of Jews that a particular person, Jesus of Nazareth, is a person of some importance, the Messiah himself, God with us. So what you need to do to accomplish that is establish a couple of things. You need to highlight this person's authority and highlight his identity as fulfillment of God's promise. You do the first, you establish his authority by pointing to his link to King David. You do the second by pointing to his link to Abraham. From David he gets royalty and authority. From Abraham he gets covenantal identity, fulfillment of God's own promises, God's own faithfulness to his people. And that's exactly what Matthew does, right? Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. He's the son of the king, and he's the son of the covenant. But that's not all Matthew does. Matthew is establishing Christ's identity by naming these names, but he's doing it in a way that is not at all ordinary. Standard procedure for this sort of thing, especially when you're trying to bolster someone's public image, is to present a pure, pristine version of that person to the world. It's the same image we all have of ourselves, the image that we all try to present to the world. We want people to think that we are smart. Together, we've got a certain status. We lack certain flaws and stains. And Matthew could certainly have done this same thing with Jesus' genealogy. Surely he would have been tempted to do this sort of thing in the face of all of these other claims about Jesus. Matthew could have designed this list of names to say, in effect, that Jesus is great because he's got great breeding. He's powerful and glorious because his ancestors were powerful, intelligent. They had status. Because he's from an untainted, stainless line. But that's not what he does. Glance back at that list of names if you have a Bible in front of you. Look for names that stand out, names that don't quite fit in with the others. Names you might not include if you were trying to shore up someone's public reputation. Matthew includes several names that don't belong. First, we have Tamar. We have a woman, a widow, who pretends to be a prostitute so that she can trick her father-in-law into impregnating her. Now, that's a story that I will probably not be reading very frequently to Margot before bedtime. Right? Then who else do we have? We have Rahab, who was an actual prostitute. Then we have Ruth, a poor widow who's not even Jewish, in a Jewish genealogy. And then we have Bathsheba. Except Matthew doesn't say Bathsheba, does he? He says the wife of Uriah. Now, why is that? He says, David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Remember, King David had Uriah killed so that David could take Uriah's wife, Bathsheba, for himself. Matthew is putting the dirty laundry right in the reader's face. This is a very strange genealogy. And this is his opening move. This is Matthew pulling the curtains back on the story of Jesus. This is the first bookend that will hold the story together. What we see in this simple list of names is something profoundly important for understanding not just the story of Christ's birth, but the whole gospel. Indeed, the whole story of God's work with and love for creation. Matthew is writing to a population, many of whom have heard about Jesus. They've heard that he breaks the law. They've heard that he sullies himself by not only not blaming the poor for their poverty, the sick for their sickness, but actually eating with and caring about the poor and the sinners and the lame and the prostitutes. They know that he's not glorious, pristine, and shiny, at least not in the ways that most people define those words. What we see from the first words in this book, from this list of names that sets up the birth story, is that contrary to those who would look down on such a seemingly insignificant birth, a blemished and lowly life, is that this has been the story all along. The story of God's work with creation, of God's love for creation, has been a story involving the last and the least and the lost all along. God's wisdom, God's love, God's work and power is not limited to the pure, the powerful, the pristine. God's power is shown in weakness. God's activity and faithfulness is revealed despite human sinfulness and failure. And God's presence and peace are not the peace of Rome, peace at any violent price, peace by crushing the opposition. God brings his peace against our destruction in the form of an infant. Emmanuel, God with us, God born in human flesh, uniting humanity forever with God's own eternal life and love in the person of Jesus Christ. And by hearing this story again and again, we hear of God's love for us despite our failures, our hatreds, our injustice. We hear of God's presence and power in the last places we would expect to find them. We hear a message saying to those who think too highly of themselves, to those tempted, as we all are, to find their value, to place their trust in their status, in their wealth, their car, their job. Stop it. You don't stand as firmly as you may think. To celebrate this birth is to proclaim something, to declare something. To celebrate this birth is to declare that there is much more to our lives than any of those things. To celebrate this story is not just to sing songs about him, but to bow to him with our minds, with our lives, to be united with him, enfleshed with God, in his selfless, unclean, boundary and law-breaking love. And to those tempted to think too lowly of themselves, those tempted into believing that their sins, their stains, their failures, their apparent lack of numbers, that these things make them small or weak or without value. Stop it! Your value is not in your strength. Your value is not in your numbers, but in your love, in your unfailing concern for each other and for those the world leaves behind. I've got this next part coming up. I've got to steel myself for it. In eastern Aleppo, an unarmed aid group known as the White Hats has been doggedly, determinedly rescuing survivors and helping them to escape. I saw a video a couple days ago of a pair of White Hats that rushed towards a massive collapsed building that had been bombed, knowing that there was a two-week-old infant underneath that might be alive. They dug at the rubble for hours until they heard a child crying, and then they finally pulled him out. That small moment, that small action, was an enormous act of love. And all of this reminded me of one of my favorite quotes from Dorothy Day. She says, I can't remember if I've read this to you before, but if I have, it's okay because it's worth repeating. The sense of futility is one of the greatest evils of the day. People say, what can one person do? What is the sense of our small effort? They can't see that we can only lay one brick at a time, take one step at a time. We can be responsible only for the one action of the present moment. But we can beg for an increase of love in our hearts that will vitalize and transform all our individual actions, and know that God will take them and multiply them, as Jesus multiplied the loaves and fishes. So let's come back once more to the heart of Matthew's first chapter. And then we're going to listen to one of my favorite songs about the birth of Christ. Matthew says, "She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." All this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. "Look, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel," which means God is with us. This song is by Chris Rice. It's called "Welcome to Our World."